find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself. Here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sophie Kühner.
Today we're going to talk about ADHD, which is a topic which is currently quite heavily discussed on many social media websites from many perspectives, and a lot of people share the process, for example, of their diagnosis or why they might believe they have ADHD. And today we are here with Ali Domet, who is a professor of neuroscience at the King's College in London. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And as always, we play our short get-to-know game, where we give our guest 5 sentences and ask our guest to finish them as spontaneously as they can. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
An architect, which is a bit odd because I didn't end up as an architect at all, but that's what I wanted to be.
Why did you want to be an architect? Was it just fascination for buildings or?
I'm not sure, actually. I think I liked design at school, so I thought that was an obvious thing to do. But I was put off by spending 7 years at university qualifying. And I ended up obviously spending well over 7 years at university and having a whole career in university. So I'm not really sure why, but that's what I wanted to do when I was at school.
Our second sentence is, if I was an emoji, I would be?
The angry one. I think I'm always the angry one. I think I'm just very flammable and fiery, so I would be the angry one.
The red face or the yellow faced angry one?
The red face with the eyebrows. Okay. Yeah, the really angry one.
So you're going all in. The next sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Go for a run and walk my dog. And my two favorite things.
Next sentence. Right now, I'm most fascinated by?
Women's mental health. So I'm looking a lot at that, both, just from a personal perspective, but also just in research, trying to look at women's health and particularly how it aligns with ADHD. So they're my sort of things, areas that I'm thinking about both personally and professionally.
Hopefully hear a bit more about this later on. Our last sentence. I know it's time to call it a day when?
My eyes are not capable of reading what is on the screen. I'm absolutely terrible at stopping work. And you can tell when your eyes are like twitching and you're just not really reading stuff. That's when it's like, okay, it's time to stop now.
I feel like that's one of the, well, it's a quite common pattern among scientists that they say, well, I work until I can't focus or until I read a sentence and don't comprehend what is written there.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people working very long hours, I think, in this area.
You mentioned that as a kid you wanted to be an architect, but you did not end up in architecture. Where did you start your whole academic path, and how did you get researching ADHD?
So I actually... originally, after I decided that I didn't want to be an architect because it was going to take too many years at university to qualify, I decided that I wanted to be a forensic psychologist. And this was caused by, there was a program on at the time in the UK, I don't know how far around the world it spread, called Cracker, which starred Robbie Coltrane, who in later life went on to be in the Harry Potter films, so sort of got quite wide spread recognition. But he played a forensic psychologist. And it was a TV program, so it was all this excitement and, you know, catching all these criminals by profiling. It was all very exciting. And so myself and probably many others of a generation thought, that's it, we want to be forensic psychologists, we want to be like Cracker. So I went off to Sheffield University in the UK to study psychology. Once I got there, pretty early on actually, in the first year of my degree, I thought, I'm not actually that keen on quite a lot of the elements of psychology. And I realized that I liked the biological side, so I liked the neuroscience side. Unfortunately, because of the nature of the degree, there obviously were core modules. So I had to do social psychology, I had to do cognitive psychology and developmental, but Sheffield University was quite a neuroscience-y psychology department. So I was able to choose lots of neuroscience options, which I did. And then I thought in my third year that I'd like to do a PhD, and I went to speak to somebody there about it. And they said, that just because of some staffing changes, it would be sensible to kind of go and occupy myself for about a year and then come back. And they suggested going off to King's in London to do a master's in neuroscience, which I did, which was quite a academic leap. It was really hard to go from a psychology degree to suddenly being taught about neuroimmunology when you'd never learned about immunology in your first degree. It was really hard. And then after I'd done that, I went back to Sheffield to do my PhD. And the original aim of the PhD was actually to look at addiction and drugs of abuse in animals. And pretty much on day one, they said, actually, we've had a different idea. We're going to look at a different brain structure, but still looking around dopamine, which, of course, is central to addiction. And so from there, I kind of focused in a different area. Went off, did a postdoc afterwards, and accidentally circled back to ADHD, really by going back to the brain structure that my PhD had been focused on and my undergraduate dissertation, which is a structure called the superior colliculus. And that kind of brought me back into ADHD, and then I made the shift out of animal work entirely into human samples and carried on from there and went into populations with ADHD. So I wouldn't say it was a planned route. I've just kind of found my way, and now I've found a bit that I feel quite happy, and I'm going to stay there hopefully for as long as I can.
It sounds like, well, meeting or talking to the right people at the right point, making the right decisions, and then ending up in a space where, well, you're now quite happy, or seemingly quite happy.
Yeah.
Maybe for our, like, for the listeners who don't, who might have heard the term ADHD but don't really know what it is, could you just briefly explain what ADHD is? Is it, well, what is ADHD? Just really broad.
So ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, which is actually a slightly misleading name, but I'll come back to why that's misleading in a minute. It's a condition, think of it as a neurodevelopmental condition, which means that it typically will emerge in childhood. And actually, according to the diagnostic criterion, it must emerge in childhood, but it doesn't have to be diagnosed during childhood. So the symptoms should be present. And the symptoms fall into two broad categories. The name obviously suggests some problems with attention. So one of those categories is around inattention. So people with ADHD can have lots of difficulty attending to a task, not making careless mistakes when they're doing something, staying focused on a task if it's quite an intense or long activity. The other half of the symptoms that we can see fall into a category that's labelled hyperactive impulsive. So that's your stereotype that you see in a lot of the general media coverage of ADHD. So the child running around, so picking up things and touching things they're not meant to be touching. And for adults, of course, other forms of impulsive behaviour. The reason the name is a little bit misleading is you don't actually have to exhibit both types of those symptoms. So you could have ADHD and have what we consider to be the hyperactive impulsive type, which means that you don't really have any problems with attention, but you do have problems with hyperactivity and impulsivity. In reality, most people with ADHD have symptoms across both of those types. So they do have some difficulties with sustained attention, but they also have difficulties with hyperactivity and impulsivity. So although the name implies it's very attention focused, it's actually a broader thing than that. And what's critical, and I think is often lost in quite a lot of the social media coverage of ADHD, is it isn't just about exhibiting difficulties with attention or hyperactivity and impulsivity. Those difficulties have to result in functional impairment. And that could take various formats. It could be difficulties in social situations. It could be difficulties in the workplace or in your academic studies. But the point is that it isn't just about having a symptom or not having a symptom, it's the impact of that symptom on individuals. And it affects around 5% of children and adolescents, and around 2/3 of those will go on to continue to have symptoms as adults as well.
You've mentioned that usually for diagnosis, the symptoms have to already been present in childhood, but how does it usually show? How you've mentioned that it's not only the attention deficit or hyperactivity, but and how far are made actions, decisions, etc., be impacted by the condition?
Yeah, so quite considerable changes to behaviour can be seen with ADHD. So the childhood kind of threshold, the point at which symptoms have to have been present, according to the DSM, which is one of our diagnostic manuals that we use, is before 12 years of age. So you're really talking primary school level children. And in that case, this might be exhibited in, if they're inattentive, staring out the window, not appearing to pay attention in class and in another setting as well, probably the home. It could be around fidgeting, interrupting others. So of course, young children do interrupt. It'd be really difficult to find a 3 or 4 year old that doesn't interrupt in certain settings. But the key is that these things are developmentally inappropriate. So the child is perhaps at a point or an age where they should know how to wait their turn. And they do know how to wait their turn, but they're not actually able to do that. So it's things like interrupting, fidgeting, as I said, staring out the window, not appearing to listen. And some of those behaviours then can create difficulties for the child in interacting with their family, with their peers at school. And that then can result in other disruptions because they're actually struggling in typical interactions. So there's all sorts of different behaviours that can appear, and there's quite a long list of symptoms, and somebody doesn't have to display all of them, but you might expect them to display maybe 6 of the 9 symptoms that are listed, and exactly how they display them will be carefully looked at by the clinician. So it won't be a simple case of I would expect that to be displayed by somebody always interrupting. It might be different to that, but it would be a similar principle.
Yeah, and I think the cliche is that, well, I know by now this is quite an outdated cliche, but that mainly boys are affected by ADHD. What's the reason for overseeing it in girls for quite a long time?
So, yeah, historically ADHD has been seen as a childhood condition and a condition of badly behaved boys. You know, there's been some quite negative and stigmatizing media coverage. And it is often seen as a male disorder or predominantly male disorder. That is changing. So when we now see, when we see statistics from children, it is still more common to find it in boys than girls. But when we see statistics from adults, it's more similar, which in part suggests that we're just diagnosing girls later. So they're not being picked up in the childhood statistics, but they are in the adult ones. And there's all sorts of reasons why we might have overlooked girls earlier on. Historically, the research that underpins the diagnostic criteria has been largely on boys. So we see a similar pattern to what we've seen in things like autism. And actually, I was reflecting on this today and I thought autism's kind of carved out a path. And I think ADHD is treading that same path. And that's a path around diagnosis, around gender, around stigma, how people with autism wish to be referred to. And all these conversations are now happening for ADHD a little bit later than they happened for autism. But our research had focused on boys. So presentation of symptoms was very male. And so clinicians would have not necessarily been looking for ways that that same symptom could be expressed in a more female way. So we have some potential challenges in applying the diagnostic criteria to females. The other thing is that females are much better at mimicking their peers, or we could call that masking. So when you have a neurodivergent individual who perhaps has ADHD or autism or both, their behaviour might be different to somebody who doesn't. But females are better at mimicking the behaviour of somebody that doesn't. So they're not getting on the radar. And given that ADHD, in order to be diagnosed, you have to have difficulties in more than one setting. So it isn't just at home. It's normally for children at home and in the school setting. A teacher with 20, 30 kids in the classroom is not necessarily going to be alarmed or concerned about a girl who's sat at the back daydreaming. They are going to be alarmed by somebody who's rocking back and forth on their chair and taking things from somebody else's desk and being a bit more overtly disruptive. So if that's how it presents more in boys, that teacher is going to flag concerns about the boy who's being disruptive, not the girl who's staring out the window. So we probably miss them for various reasons. What we know is that girls and women tend to get diagnosed more commonly, girls and women with ADHD tend to get diagnosed more commonly with depression and anxiety. So I think they internalize their experience more. Boys, they're more likely to have externalizing co-occurring conditions like conduct disorder and things like that. So they're keeping it to themselves, in effect, and so it's being missed. But that is changing. We are seeing an increase in recognition of ADHD in girls and women.
Just would like to tap on the that you mentioned that, well, that other disorders are diagnosed before ADHD. Are there other common misdiagnoses? Because I know, well, I do have quite a couple of friends who have had quite a lot of different diagnoses which have also impacted their lives, of course, but which actually were ADHD, but just hasn't been recognized in them.
That's a really interesting point. So when you think about a diagnosis somebody might get before they get a diagnosis of ADHD, there's a question over that of, is it a misdiagnosis? So is it that somebody should never have been diagnosed with depression? They should have been diagnosed with ADHD. Or is it that the diagnosis of depression was valid because they had depression, but maybe they had depression because they had undiagnosed ADHD? And there's two slightly different issues there. And I think it's quite difficult to tell because, you know, people's health does change over time. Certainly you can have depression in your 20s and not experience it in your 30s, for example. And with ADHD, the symptoms fluctuate over time as well. So we know that children with ADHD are more likely to have hyperactive impulsive symptoms. But by the time you get to adulthood, these tend to have reduced slightly. So it is a really tricky thing of, were other diagnoses incorrect, or did they arise simply because somebody was trying to manage undiagnosed ADHD and struggling with that, and that left them with depression and anxiety? Or actually, do they just have depression and anxiety quite separately from whether or not they have ADHD? And I don't think we know the answers to that yet. And I think it may vary a little bit case by case as well.
Yeah.
I have one more question, because earlier you mentioned that the same symptom might present differently in boys versus girls. Could you give an example for that?
Yeah, so I guess in the inattention one, for example, a little boy who's not attending could be replacing their task focus on the thing they're meant to be doing with focusing on something else that's incorrect. And so it's picked up that they're not attending because they're doing the wrong thing. Whereas for a little girl, they might not be directing their behavior somewhere else because they're not attending. They might just not be listening. But you don't necessarily initially even know they're not listening. You know, if they're looking at you, they appear to be listening to what's going on. But also they're not. So the inattention that they're displaying could be slightly different to how it displays in a boy. We see similar things. So there's been similar discussion around autism. For example, the special interests that can sometimes be found in autism. The special interests that are given in the a lot of the time as examples are very male special interests. Whereas if a girl has a special interest in, say, playing with dolls, well, it's not a special interest. Girls just like playing with dolls. So it's these kind of, some of them feed into gender stereotypes as well. And girls are gender stereotyped to you know, be nice and quiet and sit there and giggle and not, you know, they're not meant to be throwing things across the room and playing in a more raucous way, which boys are. So it's sometimes that actually the symptoms are being presented in such a way that aligns so much with gender stereotypes that we don't realize they're symptoms.
That makes sense. So a lot of symptoms that are typically presented with children and that are also often discussed in context of ADHD, do they change when people go into adulthood?
So there is some indication that the symptoms people display might change. So if you had difficulties with hyperactivity, you might not have those difficulties when you're a grown-up. But then I guess there's a question around, if you struggle with inattention as a child and you struggle with it as an adult, does it look different in that struggle? And I think that's a really difficult question to answer because, of course, our context changed so wildly. You know, when you think about how we operate as a school child, we go to school, we do our lessons. They might last a couple of hours before we get a break or lunchtime or whatever. And then we go home and do something else. There is an element of our attention being controlled because we have a structure, we have school. But when you're an adult, you go to the workplace and it's hugely variable what can happen. I remember having a conversation with somebody once who didn't work in academia, and they were completely perplexed that nobody gave me a set of tasks to do each day, that I just worked out what I was doing and I just got on with it. And yet I would find it really weird if I went into a workplace where somebody said, okay, that needs doing, that needs, because I'd think, well, I've never had that before. And I think as an adult, our context varies so widely that it's highly likely that how our symptoms would present would differ. But there's another kind of a chicken and egg situation here, because it could be that somebody with ADHD thinks, well, actually, I attend best in this type of activity. So I'm not going to take a job that includes all the kinds of activities that I'm not very good at. I'm going to go for one that I am good at. So I think it's quite difficult to know how much the impairment remains and how much the symptoms have changed, or they're just being managed differently, because we have more flexibility and choice as adults, many of us, than we did in a conventional school classroom. And the other side of that is that by the time we get to adulthood, rightly or wrongly, most neurodivergent people have learned to function in a neurotypical world. So they have compensation strategies. We've done some research recently with university students, and we wanted to look at how much mental effort they put into certain tasks and how they did on these tasks. These were learning tasks, so we were trying to look at education. And what we found was that neurodivergent students, so this wasn't just ADHD, we included individuals with ADHD, autism, or dyslexia, but neurodivergent students put in much greater mental effort to the task. And we had various measures using eye tracking and recording of brain activity, as well as their self-reported measures. But they did exactly the same on the tasks as the neurotypical people. So if you just looked at performance, they were performing the same, but they were having to work so much harder to do that, which I think raises some concerns about our education systems and our platforms. But what that shows us is that they'd effectively compensated. And these were people, university students, so 18 upwards. It's not actually a massive period of their life that they've had, but they've already learned to compensate. So it is really tricky to know, because people will learn to compensate for their symptoms, play to their strengths. And most people will have learned that by adulthood.
Besides the academic field, and how far does ADHD influence day-to-day life? So daily activities, home, course, etc.
So quite considerably. When you talk to people with ADHD, the level of impact varies, but it varies kind of about how they've decided to manage their life. So one of the things that I find really interesting is when you chat to people about ADHD, about having ADHD, they'll often bring up their partner or their kids or whatever. And actually, this makes sense, because ADHD impacts the quality of life of the individual. So we know that those with ADHD report lower quality of life, but it also impacts the quality of life of those immediately around them. So as an example, and of course, this is a generalization. It's important to say that not everybody with ADHD would do this kind of thing. And there are plenty of people, parents without ADHD, that would do this. But, you know, these days your child comes home and they need particular things for their home ec or cooking class. And you know that they give you the recipe on the Sunday and you think, okay, I've got to get all those ingredients for Thursday. And some people, of course, will just forget. Some people will have them all, or they might get them all together, but actually forget to send them off with their child. So there's, and when you have ADHD, you're more likely to show difficulties in planning and working memory. So you're going to forget to do some of those things. So your child is the child that turns up without the stuff. And that can cause stresses and strains at home. Similar, of course, with a partner. You say you're going to hoover up the living room and you don't, because you get distracted and do something else. It's not that you've forgotten. It's not that you're intentionally not doing your fair share, but that can cause difficulties. So we know that there can be difficulties in close relationships, so partner, parent, that kind of thing. There can also be social difficulties in general. And that again makes sense. You know, you have a conversation with somebody, it's meant to be a two-way street. One person always interrupting, or somebody always turning up late because they're not very good at planning their journey. People can find it difficult. Most people, of course, will be quite understanding, but you have to have that friendship for that understanding often to show. So there can be struggles with social relationships, and there can be struggles in the workplace as well. There are challenges that I think have implications for the workplace in particular around reasonable adjustments. So of course, in the UK, under the Equality Act, reasonable adjustments can be made for somebody that has a condition, including something like ADHD, but they of course have to disclose that condition, and that can be associated with stigma and difficulties. And we know there is still negative stigma around all forms of neurodiversity, including ADHD. So there's a lot of work to be done there to reduce that stigma and to create a workplace and a broader society that recognises the strengths of people with ADHD as well as the difficulties that they might have.
Before we go into stigma or misconceptions about ADHD, are there any benefits or strengths in individuals with ADHD? Because now we've heard quite a lot about difficulties individuals have, but well, we are all somewhere on a spectrum and we all have strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, absolutely. So historically, science is great and medicine is great, or health is great, at looking at what's wrong with people. You know, you don't go to the doctors to tell them you're brilliant at something or you're feeling particularly healthy, do you? It just doesn't work like that. And science funding and interest also is about fixing problems. And I always think a really good example of this is if you have a really talented mathematician, you don't look at their brain to see why they're good at maths. Instead, you look at the brains of people with dyscalculia to find out why they might find maths difficult. And so historically, we have very much focused on the impairment side of ADHD. But with the neurodiversity movement, which is a movement which views ADHD as a neurodifference, not a neurodeficit, we're moving away from that and starting to recognize the strengths of ADHD. And there's all sorts of potential strengths. And I say potential strengths, not because I don't think they exist, but because there's such a small amount of research on this because of that deficit focus that we've had in research and health. There is research suggesting there may be strengths around creativity and divergent thinking, curiosity as well. And actually, some research that's taken a very evolutionary perspective and said, actually, being very distractible had its advantages when we had a lot of, you know, there were more predators for us. It was helpful to be very distracted by everything in your environment because it stopped you being eaten. And of course, these days, few things are going to eat us on a day-to-day basis in most places. So it's being considered a bit of a disadvantage, but actually there can be times when it could be beneficial to be very alert and very capable of identifying distractors in the environment. But I think most of the focus going forward, or my feeling about that, and other people may see things differently, that I would imagine creativity is an area which I think warrants much exploration for people with ADHD. And actually, possibly related to the creativity and the curiosity, is hyperfocus. So we take, you know, the name is attention deficit, which implies a deficit in attention. And of course, there are impairments in attention, but actually that deficit can be too much attention in ADHD. Which again is a bit counterintuitive in the name. But if you think of kind of attention as being something you want just the right amount of, then a deficit could be too little or too much. And individuals with ADHD can show hyperfocus, which can be problematic for them. I've spoken to people that have simply forgotten to eat lunch, forgotten to attend a meeting, or not realised they needed the toilet until they were absolutely desperate and then had to, you know, run down the corridor and up two flights of stairs to get to the loo because they were so focused on something. But on the other hand, we've all done tasks where we thought, if I could just concentrate a little bit more. And if that's something someone with ADHD can hyperfocus on, that can be considered some kind of superpower.
Okay, I know that, especially from friends who are having ADHD and are quite well into coding, so programming, they yes. tend to be super good in solving and debugging their programs, just because they hyperfocus for 12 hours or something on the laptop. They do forget to eat, to drink, etc., but they manage solving coding issues like no, I think, well, a small amount of neurotypicals would be able to.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, and it goes back to the idea of adults versus children. When people can find their niche, and potentially find their niche as a coder or somebody that you know, in the creative arts, things like that. So we're currently exploring the options for funding to look at musicians with ADHD. You know, it takes a lot to become a professional musician. Of course, it takes talent, but it also takes a lot of practice. And that practice might benefit from hyperfocus and some of the sensory sensitivities that come with ADHD as well, in the case of music. But it's about finding your niche. And if you can work on something, either have a whole career in that, or at least have tasks within your day-to-day life as an adult that align with your hyperfocus abilities, you could do those tasks considerably better than somebody without ADHD. And I think as a society, we're not really harnessing that, and we're not really celebrating those abilities yet.
So we've also already kind of mentioned that there are some misconceptions about ADHD. For example, the difference in boys and girls getting diagnosed. What are some other common misconceptions about ADHD?
So I think we have made quite good progress in awareness around ADHD to reduce misconceptions. So gender does remain the dominant one, that it is a condition just associated with boys. Also that it is just a condition associated with children. So there will be some people who are line managing or recruiting in big companies that sort of are faced with a candidate with ADHD, and they'll say, well, that they can't have ADHD because they're a grown up. And that's not true. We see more negative or stigmatizing misconceptions where people say, well, actually, they don't have ADHD, they're badly behaved. And that's particularly common in children. And that then leads to assumptions being made about the parenting. So saying, well, that person doesn't have ADHD, they just have poor parenting. If the parents just disciplined them, if the parents just stepped in, it would all be better. So there are some misconceptions that this is something somebody can control, either the parent or the individual themselves, and that it is something that is preventable. Like all things, there are risk factors. So, you know, it's not a case that if this particular thing happens, you will always have ADHD. But I think we need to move away from the fact it's not, you know, the biggest misconception then is that it's not a real condition. You know, there are changes in the brain, both in the structure of the brain and the functioning of the brain. There are changes in neurotransmitters within the brain, so the chemical messengers. So there's a lot of evidence that there are real changes. And when we recognize there are real changes, whether we want to call them deficits or differences, it shouldn't really matter. That makes it a real condition.
It also sounds like that these misconceptions make it even more difficult. So when people with ADHD already struggle to complete what they ought to do at work or like in their studies, then people also dismiss them and tell them they're just not putting in the effort. I think that must be very hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And that relates to the negative stigma of it, but also, so they have the stigma for saying they have ADHD, and then they're almost, in some cases, they could be belittled because people don't believe it's a real condition. So I think that's really important. The other thing around misconceptions, I guess, is that there could be a misconception that someone with ADHD is somehow less intelligent, less able. And there's no evidence for that. You know, people with ADHD can come out of school with no qualifications, or they could have higher degrees. It's just as it is in people who haven't got ADHD. It's variable, but there is no evidence that they are less capable. But I think that can come in. So it can come in as a misconception. You're not making enough effort to do your job, but also, well, you're not clever enough to do whatever you're trying to do because you have ADHD. One of the challenges, which I wouldn't say is a misconception about ADHD, but it can be a misconception about the person with ADHD, is that they know what they need to help them. And this again comes back to educational interventions, reasonable adjustments in the workplace. You can go to your, your lecturer or your boss at work, and you can say, I have ADHD. Are there any reasonable adjustments that can be made to help me? And they can turn around and say, well, what do you need? And whilst that sounds really supportive, and in many levels it is very supportive because you're asking the person what they think is helpful, there is also an assumption they know what is helpful. And for many, especially if you're diagnosed as an adult, it might be a really new experience for you and you don't actually know. So I think one of the misconceptions is that we or somebody with ADHD knows what they need to thrive. And actually, I think the research isn't there. And so many people don't know. And it will vary person to person. What one person needs, another person won't find helpful at all.
I think my assumption there would just also be, since people with neurodivergence are socialized in a neurotypical world, so they only learn how they should function, but well, they also need to learn what they need to in order to function as well as a neurotypical person in a neurotypical world. So then, of course, asking a person, what do you need, is an offering of helping and supporting. But then again, if the person never learned to figure out what they need, they can't do it themselves.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. And I think the what do you need question is a really, you know, it not nearly always, I think, comes from a very good place. It's not like people are trying not to be supportive. They are actually trying to be very supportive. But it raises the question about what someone would need. You know, as a kind of counter example there, if you went to your doctor and you'd been diagnosed with cancer, it's unlikely your doctor would go, well, what do you need? I mean, they might say, these are the things we're going to offer. Is there anything else you think is helpful? But they wouldn't put it all on you to know about it. And by that, of course, I'm not trying to belittle the experience of somebody with cancer or somebody with ADHD, but merely draw parallels that we wouldn't expect somebody to have, your typical person to have all the answers if they have a diagnosis of cancer themselves. That's what professionals are there, and the research has delivered some interventions and treatments that could be helpful. And with ADHD, I think whilst we've got treatments for ADHD, some of which work very well, it's still at a point where we're having a blossoming community of people with ADHD to share their own experiences. And it's through that that I think some of the good things to try and less good things to try might emerge for individuals.
You just mentioned that there's quite a community of people affected by ADHD rising. And, well, I think one place where ADHD gets a lot of more public attention today is social media, especially if, like, I'm mostly active on Instagram, so I just mainly see it on Instagram, where people share their experiences, share how they've been maybe also late diagnosed, how this has affected their lives, etc. But I also feel that sometimes patterns or things are shared that are still quite normal, but are put under the label of being typical ADHD patterns. Well, does social media help in the whole topic of ADHD, or does it rather give people who are totally neurotypical the sense of having ADHD just because they recognize themselves in what is described?
Yeah, I mean, the role of social media, it's always going to be a double-edged sword. There was some research recently that looked at the top videos on TikTok relating to ADHD. So these videos, there were I can't remember how many they were, but the selection they included, whatever they classed as the top, had been viewed by millions of people. And the videos were made by different types of creators. So sometimes they were like scientists, sometimes they were health professionals, sometimes they were individuals with ADHD. And across all of those, they found that around 50% were inaccurate when they were looked at by psychiatrists who did not know who the creators were either. So they weren't, I mean, I guess some of them they might have known if they were celebrities, but at least they were looking at the content rather than exactly who was delivering them. And they found that over half were inaccurate. Social media can be a tool for good. It can be an excellent way of raising awareness, of destigmatizing something. As a classic example of this, I'm of a generation that all watch Kylie Minogue's character marry Jason Donovan's character on Neighbours. And we all loved Kylie and Jason, and we followed Kylie Minogue's career for many, many years. And when she got diagnosed with breast cancer, it effectively had something we can call the Kylie effect. Suddenly everybody thought, oh, breast cancer can affect everyone. I should go and get that thing checked. And we see a massive raising of awareness. So having people share their lived experiences, particularly people in high profile positions, celebrities, and we do have celebrities talking about their ADHD, can be really beneficial because it can raise awareness in a way that someone like me, a scientist, going on Instagram, no one wants to follow a scientist that's going to sit there and go, so I've done a study and it took me 4 years. You know, that it's not as interesting. It's not as engaging. Lived experience is engaging. It's the premise of much of our entertainment industry. So it is valuable. But is there a risk that the things that are being presented are not accurate and actually we're causing people to worry that they have ADHD when they don't have ADHD? And yes, that's certainly a risk. And I think I heard it put really nicely, which is social media is a good doorway. It is not the only source of information. So you may see a video on social media and think, oh yeah, I do all of those things. Maybe I should explore the idea of an ADHD diagnosis a little more. And at that point, it's about going off to key organizations, charities, healthcare professionals, and exploring it. I don't think anybody should be self-diagnosing on the basis of social media alone or putting themselves forward for a diagnosis by a professional on the basis of social media alone. And I think there's quite a lot of responsible use of social media for that purpose where people do identify, oh, if this has concerned you or you know, go to this source of information. So there can be a responsible use, but it is certainly a worry. And one of the things that concerns me as well is that it can go the other way. So it can belittle the experiences of somebody that has been struggling with ADHD for years. In a conversation I was having earlier today, somebody sort of said there's a condition of the month or a, something that can be really topical. And a few years back it was bipolar. You know, you kept hearing, oh, everybody's got bipolar disorder these days. And we've also heard, I think we've probably all used the statement, you know, I'm a little bit OCD. No, you're not a little bit OCD. You just like having your house tidy. That doesn't mean you have OCD, but that's how it's used. People sort of go, they line up their desk and they go, oh, sorry, I'm a little bit OCD. And actually OCD can be a really crippling condition. And it is way more than liking things nice and tidy on their desk. It can be absolutely horrific for people to live with. So I think when we sort of see somebody going, oh, I'm rubbish at paying attention, but then I can focus on this for hours, I've got ADHD. It's way more than that. So I think it's a really good way to raise some awareness of the condition. It can also be a very good way for people who have ADHD to come together and support each other, and we should not underestimate the value of that. But we need to be mindful of using social media to open the door, not answer the questions, and to consult other sources. And I think it's not actually about ADHD, it's about being critical of information. We live in an information world. How easy is it to find stuff out instantly? You know, either from talking to our nice home AI, checking something on our phones, we can find stuff out so easily. But we just need to remember that there's a lot of misinformation out there or half information. So always work to verify what we find. And that's not ADHD specific. It's important when it's health, but it's important for everything.
Do you think more science communication on social media could have a positive impact? Or do you think that people still would prefer the individual experiences so much more?
I think it could have a positive impact to have decent science communication on social media. Absolutely, it can. The challenge is these social media channels. You know, you've got like 40 seconds for a particular video. There is only so much hard science you can get across in 40 seconds. So you have to reduce the detail, and then you risk overgeneralizing the findings. But it definitely can, and we see some outstanding science communicators who are scientists or who are trained in communicating in a way that isn't misinforming. Do I think it would be preferred? Probably not. You know, we know that we like learning about people. People are social creatures. So do I want to hear a bland study about exercise in ADHD, or do I want to hear somebody with ADHD telling me how they personally used exercise? Well, the latter is far more interesting. And engaging. So it takes a really, really engaging science communicator to be more engaging than somebody who's telling you about their lived experience. And I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. Of course, you can have a science communicator who has lived experience of something, but often you don't. So yeah, I think it's just about going for a balance in the sources.
I think just one person that came to my mind she's German, so she's not communicating in English, but she's a psychologist who has been educating about ADHD for about a year and putting out 3 to 4 videos each week just on different aspects of ADHD, and has now revealed that she's also diagnosed since last year. And I think she kind of combines both in that way, but also I feel like many professionals who are working with it don't really would want to reveal that they are also diagnosed, just because of also stigma that they might be facing.
Yeah, and that is a real issue. So I've seen that in some of my own research with some of the researchers that I work with, where I might know, or sometimes where actually I don't know, and I find out afterwards, and I think, oh, that's weird, they didn't say. But I can see that can be an issue around stigma. And of course, you know, one of the things we as scientists are always told is science should be really objective. And it's very difficult, or people could argue that it's difficult to remain objective about something when it's something that personally affects you. But then I also think you get to a certain point in science where you really are in it because you're passionate about the topic. And you can only be so objective when you're very passionate about something. And of course, it doesn't impact necessarily how you conduct the research, but it might impact how you communicate. How enthusiastic you are when you talk about some research findings might differ to others, and all of these implicit cues around things. But ultimately, you know, it is important to raise awareness about something, and every time you raise awareness, you risk spread of misinformation. It's the two kind of go hand in hand.
We've now talked quite a lot about how ADHD shows, how it impacts life, and also how, society perceives it. I know that there are different methods of treating ADHD. Some are drug-based, some are purely behavior-based. How is it treated most commonly, and how effective are those methods?
So the route to treatment, if you like, varies by age group. So for children, very young children, you're not likely to start them on drug treatment, but you're likely to use other interventions first. So in the UK, we have the NICE guidelines, which cover England and Wales. And for preschool children, the first approach would be parent training. So that's about helping the parent understand ADHD and understand how to support their child to behave in ways that are appropriate, but also not to be so distressed by things, because if they're struggling to work out what to do, children can find it distressing. So it's about supporting the parents to support their child. You may also have teacher training if appropriate in a school context. And for slightly older children, so this would really be around adolescence, you can start to introduce interventions, behavioral psychological interventions for the individual themselves rather than the parent or teacher. And that can include things like cognitive behavioral therapy. It can also include social skills training. I've talked about difficulties that people with ADHD can have with social relationships. So that can be really important. especially during adolescence, which is like a social minefield, navigating that period of life. So you can have that kind of thing. Those have been shown to have benefits, but it's not clear that these benefits are really significant. They can be helpful, and if nothing else, they're educating the person about their own condition, which I think is beneficial. But when we look at the most effective treatments, they are drug treatments. And at the moment, we have two classes of drugs that can be used to treat ADHD. One is psychostimulant or stimulant drugs. So that's drugs based around amphetamine and methylphenidate. And methylphenidate, which is a less known term, but it's a very similar type of drug. As I said, they're both stimulants. Methylphenidate has similar neural mechanisms to cocaine, but without, obviously, the kind of recreational abuse side of cocaine. And they both increase dopamine in the brain, so the chemical signaling molecule of dopamine. They work and they are pretty effective. They won't remove all the symptoms, but they will see a significant symptom reduction. Unfortunately, as with all drugs, of course, they have side effects. And some of those side effects could be such that a person simply cannot take them. So for a very small proportion of individuals that may have underlying heart problems, psychostimulants could be contraindicated. They have far lesser side effects as well, things like insomnia, weight loss, appetite difficulties, headaches, that kind of thing. And if somebody finds the side effects of stimulants impossible to bear at the dose that's needed to reduce the symptoms, you might put them onto non-stimulant medication. And there's fewer of these available. So in that there's still two types, but fewer are produced. So for methylphenidate and amphetamine, there's loads of variations, slow release, immediate release, and various different types. But for the non-stimulants, there's fewer options. They're generally considered to be a little bit less effective, but they have a different set of side effects, and some of those side effects might be more tolerable for some people. It takes a long time to get the right medication. People will go through periods of titration, so adjusting a dose to work out that balance between symptom reduction and side effects, and then sometimes combining stimulants or combining a stimulant with a non-stimulant and looking at different pharmacological profiles, so how quickly the drug works and dosing regimes. So all of that can take quite a while. And of course, once you've got it right, you could stay on it for a couple of years and then maybe your situation changes or your symptoms alter slightly, something else changes, and you need to go through the whole process again. So it isn't a quick fix, and the drugs only work while you've got them in your system. So it's not like you can take the medication once every month or something. It would need to be taken on a regular basis to have the benefits.
You just mentioned dopamine. I think you've already mentioned it at the beginning of our interview and now as well. What exactly has dopamine to do with ADHD?
So historically, like over about four decades, there's been a hypothesis that ADHD is caused by a deficit in dopamine. So too little dopamine, or dopamine not being used very efficiently in the brains of ADHD. As with nearly every condition and every scientific study that you look at, actually it's not going to be that simple. You know, very few conditions are caused by a decrease in one thing. So we know that dopamine is definitely involved in ADHD. Evidence from genetic studies and studies that have looked at medication effects and brain imaging studies where you can actually measure the amount of neurotransmitter or particular structures in the brain. So it's definitely involved, but it isn't a case that there's just too little of it. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and we don't really fully understand, but we certainly know that this neurotransmitter, possibly in combination with some others, is altered in some areas of the brain in ADHD, and that is what is thought to underlie the symptoms that we see.
So the difference in dopamine in some areas of the brain is kind of a difference between neurotypicals and neurodivergent people?
It's probably So I think that's a really interesting question. It's not just about dopamine. So we also see changes in structure of the brain and possible changes in the developmental trajectory. So for example, white matter development delays in the brain. So that's the kind of the pathways rather than the structures. But certainly we can logically and rationally argue that changes in dopamine can underpin certain symptoms of ADHD. So for example, if we see a reduction in ADHD in some of the areas associated with attention, that could be why we see difficulties in attention. We also see alterations in dopamine functioning in areas that are related to movement, which again could explain why we see hyperactivity. So it's not so much that dopamine explains neurodiversity as dopamine explains some of the symptoms we see in ADHD.
So basically, dopamine might be the reason for the structural changes, or do the structural changes come and then the change in dopamine comes?
So that's a good question. I don't think we fully know. We see changes in the brain, obviously, from quite a young age, but of course, the nervous system's developing all the while the fetus is developing. And it's a neurodevelopmental condition, so we would expect some changes to occur. And they're not the only changes that we see. So, for example, when we look at candidate genes, so that's genes that we think are implicated in ADHD, several of them are associated with dopamine receptors, which is why one of the reasons we think dopamine plays a role. But they're not all dopaminergic genes. There's also implications for other types of neurotransmitters and other things entirely that aren't neurotransmitters. So it seems that dopamine plays a central role, but it definitely isn't the only player. And it could be that what you're actually seeing is accumulation of various risk factors, which results in structural changes in the brain, which then it confers functional changes that materialize as dopamine. So it's really difficult to know. It's like what you can think of is we found a piece of the jigsaw, but we don't know if that's a piece right in the middle that's really critical, or it's a little piece down the bottom that just somewhere along the line led to the thing that caused it. So we're not there yet.
Which brain structures typically differ between people with ADHD and neurotypicals?
So there's been a huge range of studies on this, and obviously no one study on its own is sort of perfect, really. So it's hard to make any firm deductions, but we know that things like the prefrontal cortex are the bit just behind the eyes. It's important in selective attention and also in things like impulse control. That seems to be reduced in volume in ADHD, which you would expect from the symptom profile. We also see changes in the basal ganglia, which is a group of structures important for movement. Again, you might expect that from the symptom profile. But there's also changes in structures like the cerebellum and the amygdala. The amygdala, which is a structure important for emotion processing, isn't as much of an oddity as it sounds, because people with ADHD often struggle with emotional dysregulation. So though it's not listed as a core symptom, it is often considered a central feature. The cerebellum's a bit harder to explain why that might be different in ADHD. And I think it's also worth saying that quite a lot of these structural imaging studies, again, have been done on children and have been done on boys. And the challenge is, well, if we want to look at girls, we might end up having to look at women because girls are not diagnosed till later. But then, of course, you've got the challenge of, are these changes caused by ADHD, or are these changes caused by ADHD and then living in a neurotypical world? Or are they changes by having ADHD and then having 10 years of psychostimulant treatment? So it's really tricky to unpick all these things. But certainly lots of different areas of the brain have been studied, and they have found various differences. And some are kind of really easily linked to the symptoms, and others it's a little bit unclear.
I was just still thinking about that you just dropped that all the brain imaging has been done on boys, just because, like, of course, when a condition is not recognized or hasn't been recognized in one gender for ages, it makes sense that none of the research has been conducted on that sex or gender. But it's just one of those things where I feel just mad instantly for the amount of negotiating or not focusing on all aspects.
Yeah, and it is increasing. You know, we are seeing far more girls and women included in research. But of course, you've got, you know, when you're looking across studies, when you're trying to look for patterns, if 70% of your research has been done on boys and men, it's quite hard to be sure that that pattern reflects ADHD as a whole and would generalize to genders other than male or boys and men. So it is really tricky, and it's changing, but it takes time for those changes to filter through.
Are there so far any findings or any studies on, well, women or girls, or is it just not yet done and will start?
There are studies. I'm not familiar with the specific examples of like structural imaging studies, for example, but we do a lot of work via online surveys for ADHD, and women love online surveys, and men less so. So we know actually just in general, women are more likely to take part in online research than men. So I think as well as we're starting to diversify our research methods, we're more likely to see a better range of population of people with ADHD taking part. A lot of the studies that have looked at non-pharmacological interventions, so we've done work on exercise and mindfulness, and lots of other groups have as well, they tend to get better representation across the genders as well. It is really interesting, and as a researcher, it's a bit of a minefield because you want to advertise your study and get people to participate, but you have to be so careful of how you advertise it. You know, I would look at, I use Instagram a lot to advertise research, and if I posted, I was doing a study where I was comparing the effects of cycling and yoga on attention and impulsivity, and if I put a picture of yoga up in my advert, I could tell, because you can see from the analytics who's clicking through, it's like 90% female. If I put a picture of cycling up, it's more even, and if anything, it's nudging towards male participants. And so you have to be really mindful of this when you're trying to recruit for studies to get people that are willing to come in and do something. You have to be so careful in your recruitment.
Well, with women especially, we do have a hormonal cycle that is much stronger compared to men. So like men have their lifelong hormonal cycle, but women have them monthly, or most menstruating people have them monthly. Does that have any impact on, well, ADHD symptoms, ADHD treatment, etc.?
Yes, so there is mounting evidence that hormonal, particularly female hormones, could impact on how ADHD presents, and not just, and by how it presents, I mean the symptoms, symptom severity, for example. So studies in women with ADHD, and they are very small studies, and there's only a handful of them, because again, we're still kind of learning to look at this area. But those studies indicate that in the period of the menstrual cycle where estrogen is at its lowest, symptoms are at their highest. And that is possibly because of an interaction between estrogen and dopamine, but taking into account, again, that dopamine isn't the only player here. But it does seem that in that period, women may benefit from extra medication to achieve the same effects that a lower dose of medication can do the week before and the week after. So there appear to be changes around the menstrual cycle. And of course, the menstrual cycle, in theory, lasts around a month, but we will have that cycle from perhaps early teens to around 50 to 51 years, 52 years of age. 51 is the average in the UK for menopause. So it's a very long period of our life. But you can think of it, although it is a monthly fluctuation that's going on for a long time, that fluctuation is actually quite small. And over the years, you learn to live with it. You know, most people that have had periods for 10, 20 years can almost guess when their period is due by A, how much they're eating, and B, how much they're concentrating, and if they're feeling active or a bit sluggish. You know, we get used to that cycle. And so women with ADHD also get used to it to a degree. And although it may have some extra difficulties for them, they're used to it. Pregnancy is an interesting one because hormonally it takes about a year postpartum to to get everything to settle down. So you might have a year or two where your hormones are fluctuating differently to how you've experienced previously to pregnancy. And there's very little research around pregnancy and ADHD. We do know that there's also sadly very little research around whether the drug treatments for ADHD are safe to use during pregnancy and breastfeeding. So the default approach is actually stop taking your medication when you're pregnant and breastfeeding, which in itself can add complications to an already quite trying time. But the biggest hormonal fluctuation actually happens in the menopause. So it's not, although you have the monthly cycle for around, 40, 50 years possibly, and pregnancy lasts for 2 years, the level of change in the hormones is massive during the menopause in comparison to those. And as a kind of, an added benefit for surviving 50 years of the menstrual cycle, the menopause transition can last for over a decade. So we think of it as being quick. It's not quick. We think of it as just being hot flushes and night sweats. It's way more than that. And so we're actually conducting research focused on the menopause. We've done one study, which we're in the process of publishing, which does show that certain types of menopause symptoms seem to be worse in women with ADHD. And exactly the pattern you find depends on whether they're taking medication or not. And that's raising some interesting questions, because we're also playing catch up with diagnosis for women. So we're seeing lots of women who are at the age of menopause transition being assessed for ADHD. And that raises a question as to whether that assessment should take into account the fact that they may be perimenopausal as well. So there's all kinds of, I guess it really is a can of worms. So we've opened this can of worms and now we're just sat there looking at it, trying to work out which is the best place to focus our research efforts. But certainly I think the menopause is something we need to look at. And for the sake of women who are pregnant, who have ADHD, I think more research needs to be done around how that affects their experiences, how that impacts how they interact with healthcare professionals, prenatal classes, postnatal, immediate postnatal support. Is that taking into account the neurodiversity and the challenges they might face? So there's lots of work to do in that area. I think it's an area of growing interest. And it also possibly offers us an area to explore for new treatments, because maybe HRT can help some people with ADHD that aren't menopausal. We don't know that, but that's the kind of question that we should be asking.
Just for listeners, HRT refers to hormonal replacement therapy.
Yes, sometimes also given another name. I think it's menopause therapy or something. But yes, HRT is basically supplementing estrogen levels and sometimes a bit more nuanced, so a whole selection of hormones, but it's trying to compensate for the change that happens.
I think especially with menopause, the most difficult thing there is that it's not even fully researched in individuals without ADHD, even menstrual fluctuations. Yeah. Like even the impact of menstrual fluctuations is not researched on neurotypicals.
The menopause is like ADHD, lots of stigma around that, so it's not really covered. And the flip side of that, so mentioning hormone replacement treatment, of course, another hormone treatment that is taken by millions, maybe even billions of women worldwide, is the pill or any form of oral contraceptive tablet. And that means that it would be interesting to do more research around that and ADHD as well. If there is that interaction between estrogen and dopamine, it follows that that might be something interesting to explore. So there's so much going on, and it's a bit with menopause, but with women and ADHD in general, there's a sort of perfect storm that's been created, and that's been created by ADHD being viewed as a male condition, along with women's health being neglected for a long time, especially women's reproductive health, and especially women of menopause age, because society has sort of written them off a little bit, to be honest. So we see them being massively a neglected group, combined with women with ADHD being a massively neglected group. And so we have this perfect storm for women in that position, which I hope research will start to address in the coming years.
I don't know if you can answer my next question, because it might be quite specific. Like, maybe for reference, I am currently doing research on menstruation, so I'm a bit in the topic of menstrual health research as well. Especially for menopause in the workplace, it's known that quite a lot of menstruating people drop out of their high position workplaces, and just because of the drop in estrogen and other hormones, then mood swings, insecurity about life decisions, basically going through puberty just all over again, but in a different life phase. My question would be, do you know if there's any evidence that this effect is more, well, stronger in menstruators with ADHD, just because they might be more impulsive from the beginning?
I don't know is the honest answer. I don't know if it would be more pronounced. People with ADHD have lower occupational status on average than those without anyway. So it might be that you couldn't actually answer that question without controlling for status in some way, and that could be tricky. But yeah, it's quite possible. I don't think the research has been done.
Okay, thanks. Honestly, I have so many more questions on menstruation, but I think then we would open a whole new episode. Then we slowly come to an end of our conversation. As we have started off as a whole cognitive science podcast, we always ask our guests what role cognition plays in the scope of their research. So for you, how would you define cognition, and how far might it play a role for what you're doing on your day-to-day basis?
So I think when I'm thinking about cognition, I'm normally thinking about it in two ways for my work on ADHD. So the first is that I am, you know, ADHD impacts attention and executive functioning, working memory. So all of those aspects of cognition are things that we will be trying to measure in the lab. The other side of the research I do, which I've mentioned briefly, is I look at learning and an educational context, higher education specifically, where of course cognition is kind of implicit in everything we're doing. We're trying to teach, we're trying to encourage students to learn. And so again, there I'm looking, I guess, at how the experience of cognition might differ in neurotypical and neurodivergent students. And it's such a big topic that you always end up having to choose something really narrow and really specific, because you can't measure everything. And, you know, for us, we sort of end up looking at things like, you know, selective attention on a very boring lab task, which is fine. But one of the things that I think we will try and move more into is what we would consider ecologically valid methods. So sort of real world measures of cognition, which are very hard to do. But that's something we're looking at.
And when people have listened to the episode, which, like, do you have one takeaway sentence or one takeaway message they should remember after getting all the information of the past hour?
I think it would be to not be tricked or fooled into thinking that ADHD is a deficit. It can be something much bigger than that, that can offer great opportunities to the individual and therefore those around them as well. So I guess it would be to say to explore more about ADHD and to approach the topic with compassion for those with the condition, but also for those without that are trying to support people, because, you know, you will be that person at some point that says, what do you need just to help you with your ADHD? And somebody might not know. So I think I would say explore more and treat the topic with compassion.
Thank you so much for talking to us. It was a real pleasure. I think Sophie and I have both been really excited talking to you. So thank you very much.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Leslie Volk, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.